morning, and especially for visiting with us. It does show, it is encouraging to each of us, does show you guys have an interest in God and in pleasing Him. This morning, I'd like to look at influence, and didn't realize that till this morning, picked this out a few weeks or a couple of months ago, that Kyle's got this lesson, his last lesson in the book that we're studying, and maybe he won't have to cover quite as much because we're going to be one lesson short there. But for an introduction, I'd like to first look at where Christ is teaching the apostles. We're going to be in Matthew 5, if you want to go ahead and turn there. I've got most of the scriptures on the screen anyway, but we'll begin in chapter 5. And I'd like to back up and look at verses 3 through 10 initially here, 3 through 12. There it says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." When we look at the poor in spirit, that's an attitude we each should have. Of course, these are Christ is teaching his disciples on characteristics that they should have or attributes that they should have. Poor in spirit, of course, is the humble, not haughty, not thinking of himself, but putting others first. In verse 4, of course, we just read, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." We know that it is better to be in the house of mourning than it is in the house of mirth there in Ecclesiastes 7 and 4. And then in verse 5, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." And again, we know the meek, a lot of people think resemble that to weak. That is not, but it's humble submission to God and no resistance to God and his will for us there. And then verse 6 says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled." Each of us should have a desire to please God and hunger and thirst to do what is right and have a righteous life and be acceptable to him. And verse 7 says, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy." And of course, we know if we don't show mercy towards other and forgiveness, then God is not going to show that to us also. Verse 8 says, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." And that's our goal. We want to be in the same relationship with God, and the only way to be able to do that, to be in a fellowship with God, a relationship with him, is to be pure in heart. Verse 9 says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, so they shall be called the sons of God." And as we've read or studying the minor prophets there, that we know there are many that have, kind of arguments over genealogies and a lot of various things that have no fruit whatsoever, just for the sake of arguing, and we're not to be one of strife, but we're to be peacemakers. Verse 10 says, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And this, in these final Beatitudes here, Jesus implies the attitude of the world is going to be displayed towards the citizens of the kingdom, the attitude of the world. And we can see here that we're going to be persecuted. That's the characteristics, or that's the attitude the world will have towards those of Christ who are trying to do right. Verse 11 says, "Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." So again, the world will say all kinds of evil against those falsely for his sake. We can look back at Christ. He had false witnesses there. Stephen, same thing there. They pulled up false witnesses when they were trying to convict him. The apostles, we see that happening all over. And the world's going to persecute them just as it did the prophets before them. John the Baptist, Christ, again, all the others who were persecuted there for standing up and saying what is right. So the influence of the world upon the kingdom will often be one of persecution. And then Jesus kind of took the other side of it too here that we need to look at, the influence of the kingdom on the world. In other words, the church. When we're talking about the kingdom, Christ is head of the church. He's also, and that's spoken of as kingdom of the world also. And that's what we're talking about here. He sits and reigns at the right hand of God, being head of the church. And the impact of the kingdom is supposed to have upon the world. We'll look at that also. First of all, In verse 13, it says, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but thrown out and trampled underfoot by men." You know, there's two metaphors that he's using here. Salt is the first one here in Matthew 5:13, the figure of salt. Salt has several characteristics. A couple of them are just it enhances flavor and it preserves. You know, based on the context here, I think we're looking at salt's ability to enhance flavor, to which Jesus is referring to in this illustration. And then it also states, but if the salt loses its flavor, and that's something we'll have to be wary of. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. But salt has the ability to give flavor to that which is otherwise bland. Job mentioned it, its ability there too in Job 6:6. Can flavorless food be eaten without salt, or is there any taste in the white of an egg? You know, through the metaphor of salt, Jesus describes the relationship of the citizens of the kingdom the world has as one of making the world palatable or bearable to God. Possibly others as well. We're supposed to have influence on others. But if you think of it, of us having that salt, it's flavored for God. It has a taste that will otherwise this world will have a distaste in it. And that kind of brings an attitude. Maybe that's why God bears so long with it. If you think of the righteous few, and it's easier for God to save the world when he has some righteous, God to forbear the wicked. You know, we can see it illustrated with Abraham in Genesis 18, 20 through 32. I don't have, you know, the verses up here. I'm not going to read that, but we all know the story there. Abraham started to ask God if he would not destroy Sodom and Gomorrah if they were righteous there, and started with 50, then God agreed to, and he went all the way down, you know, 40, 30, 20, and went down to 10. And God said, yeah, he would relent from the punishment there if he went down, and Abraham just walked away at that time because there were not even 10 that obeyed. Population at that time in Sodom and Gomorrah, hard to nail down. It's anywhere from 100,000 to 500,000, depending on who and what you read there, but just to have less than 10 be righteous there, that's pretty amazing. And that's what we're talking about, a righteous few. And God wouldn't destroy it if there were even a few more than that there. And so it's kind of amazing to see God's patience and his justice there both. And God's dealing with the Jerusalem in Jeremiah 5:1, it says, "Run to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem, seek now and know, and seek in her open places if you can find a man. If there is anyone who executes judgment, who seeks the truth, and I will pardon her." So if we're looking at it here on Jeremiah, he's told Jeremiah, he's been covering a lot of what Jeremiah, God's going to tell him, to go find some. They're questioning his punishment seemed pretty harsh, but God is telling Jeremiah here that there are none in Jerusalem that are faithful, and to go out and look and see if he can find any. And so God's going to execute judgment there, and that was his justice explaining that to him. So Jesus warns against losing our flavoring ability too. With pure salt, it never actually loses flavor. But when it's mixed with impurities, that's when it loses its ability to enhance flavor. You know, we might be too loose in our ability, or we might too also lose our ability in a flavoring agent for the world too, for others to see us, by allowing impurities into our lives. We know the verse there at 1 Corinthians 15:33, "Do not be deceived, evil company corrupts good habits." A lot of times we want to straddle the line and be friends with the world and get as close as we can, you know, and be with them all the time and still serve God. We know there's huge danger in that. And I know that many Christians and a lot of young feel that they're very strong and that the influence won't be affected by being with those that are called evil. And it seldom works out that way. Usually, you know, they think they're going to be the one that's influencing those that are acting evil, but the opposite usually occurs. Usually it's one that's, if you're around evil long enough, it's going to seep into your life also. And so we need to be careful there. We need to, Peter didn't think he would deny God either, would he? And he was pretty strong there. And so that he denied God just under the pressure there. And so we need to keep ourselves pure, as it says here in Ephesians 5, verses 3 through 7. But fornication and uncleanliness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you as fitting for the saints. Neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. For this you know, that no fornicator, unclean person, nor covetous man, who is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not be partakers with them. No corrupt word. Just think of these things. No foolish talking, no filthiness, coarse jesting. None of that is going to be acceptable to God. So we've got to be real careful about keeping ourselves pure as the flavor there and seasoning for others. How are we going to be seasoned? How are we going to be seasoned and purities prevent us from being useful? If we lose our flavor, how is that going to help any and be acceptable to God? We're going to be thrown out, as we read. If Jesus teaches we can lose our salvation, this, I think he's teaching it here. He also teaches it in other places. We can see that in Matthew 13, verses 40 through 43. Here he's given an explanation of the parable of the tares. And it says, therefore, as the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of this age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend and those who practice lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine forth as the Son of the kingdom, Son in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. So again, we know we can fall away. We know we can become impure. And we can see how it's done here in this explanation. They will gather out of his kingdom all those that offend, and then they'll be separated. And even some of those in the kingdom will be cast into punishment there. And then in Revelations 3:15-16, and here he's talking about a church there. I know your works, that you're neither hot nor cold. I wish you were cold or hot. So then because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will vomit you out of my mouth. So first of all, we're told the relationship to the kingdom from God's point of view. We can see we can lose that. We are the salt of the earth. And then let's go to Matthew 5:14-16. And here we're going to look at being the light of the world. There it says, you are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all those who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. We can see how we're to be the light of the world. Let's go ahead and look at Philippians 2:14-15 also. It says, do all things without complaining and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God, without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights of the world. We're used by God to transmit his glory to the world, and that's how we're to be as a light. The purpose is to proclaim the praises of God. 1 Peter 2:9 there tells us that we're to be children of light also. It says, but you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. And then in Ephesians 5:8-9, for you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness, righteousness, and truth. So again, here, we're children of light. And, we read the Beatitudes, the characteristics we have. Now we can see some of the fruits of the Spirit we're supposed to have also as Christians. We're supposed to have goodness, righteousness, and truth. But we got to realize we're not, Christians are not a light in and of themselves. As we saw in Ephesians 8 here, for you were once in darkness, but now you are the light. Walk as children of light. That light comes from Christ when we're in a right relationship with Him. See if I'm getting ahead of myself here. Christ is the true and the original light, as we can see here. Let me back up here in John 8 and 12. Then Jesus spoke to them again and said, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. So again, that's where our true light comes. It's Christ. In Him is all goodness. He's never known darkness. Citizens of the kingdom, as we are, or members of the church, we're luminaries reflecting that one true light of Christ. Just, as the moon reflects the light, we've had what is called, I think, an oak moon, which I never had heard of before, but supposed to be one of the brightest and longest hours of the moon shining the last day or two. 2 Corinthians 4 and 6 tells us, for it is God who commanded the light to shine out of darkness, who has shone in our hearts to give the light of knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So again, all that light that we are to show comes from God and His Word and obeying it. There's twofold responsibilities in the being the light of the world. The first one is that we must be visible. Matthew 5:14, implied by Jesus, His use of the word city and lampstand as metaphors too for each of us. Jesus therefore expects His followers to be seen by the world. That's what it tells us in John 13:35. By this, all will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. How are people going to see if we truly have the light and if we are part of God? It's if we treat each other right as part of it, if we have love for one another. If people can see how we treat one another in the world. Again, in 17:21, that they all may be one as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they may also be one in us, that the world may believe that you sent me. So we have to have the same thought, the same, and I'm talking about spiritual things here, of course, the same one attitude, one mind that we're going to have, and others in the world will see that. And then we've got to radiate the light also, give light off. This principle is conveyed by the idea of a lamp. It's designed to put up on a lampstand to give more light to a room and not hidden away. The principle stated, let your light so shine before men, and that's what we are to do. We're supposed to be such a visual, radiant light so men may glorify, so that we can glorify the Father in heaven when we're in a relationship with Him, right relationship with Him. When we're young and driving, you can do it now too. Pretty flat out here and where I grew up around Delhart, and you can go through one town, you can see the lights of the city, which is 15 miles away, the next town, and that's how we're supposed to be to the world. They should be able to see us. That's not even up on a hill like we talks about here in the scripture, but that's just a flat area, and you can see that far. And so, again, we can use that as kind of a metaphor on how we're supposed to illuminate and be a light to the world. We're to glorify God in all we do, giving, and I think we'll see here in 1 Peter 2:11 and 12 and 2 Corinthians, giving God the glory for that. 1 Peter 2:11 and 12 says, Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lust, which war against the soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. Then in 2 Corinthians 9:12 and 13, for the administration of this service not only supplies the needs of the saints, but also is abounding through many thanksgivings to God, while through the proof of this ministry, they glorify God for the obedience of your confession to the gospel of Christ and for your liberal sharing with them and all men. So again, our goal is to glorify God in this earth. It talks about giving to the needy saints. Again, how we treat each other is going to be seen by others. So the influence and impact of the citizens or the members of the church are supposed to be the salt. We're going to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. We need to be pleasing to our Father and praising Him. But there's also, you know, comes up, there's a sin of hindering others. And let's look over Galatians 5, 7 through 12. And there we can talk about the sin of being hindered or look at the point here and then look at some ways we can hinder others from serving also instead of being that light. In Galatians 5, beginning verse 7, it says, "You ran well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth? This persuasion does not come from him who calls you. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. I have confidence in you, in the Lord, that you will have no other mind, but he troubles you shall bear his judgment. He who troubles you shall bear his judgment, whoever he is. And I, brethren, if I still preach circumcision, why do I still suffer persecution? Then the offense of the cross has ceased. I could wish that those who trouble you would even cut themselves off." So Paul's expressing his concern about Christians being hindered here in their spiritual race. We know that Paul had to buffet his body daily to make sure he was the right example and did not lose any service to God there too. 1 Corinthians 9:24 says, "Do you not know those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize. Run in such a way that you may obtain it." Then Hebrews 12:1, "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." So again, you know, we can't let ourselves be hindered in this life. There's a prize that we have, a goal that we're working towards, and we've got to live our life in a way, or in other words, run in a way to obtain it, train ourselves in a way to do that. We have all these witnesses in Hebrews that talks about the examples that we're given, and we do have things that can weigh us down in this life, that can hinder us, that can pull us away from serving God, and we've got to get those out of our lives. And then I want to ask the question, you know, or look at a few things that may can hinder other Christians, how we can hinder other Christians by our life. And the first one's pretty obvious here. It's through false teachings. And let's look at Galatians. We're going to back up and look at the first six verses before we read about seven in there and talking about being hindered. And this is why some of them were being hindered here, was the false teaching. There it says, "Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty by which Christ has made us free. Do not be entangled again with a yoke of bondage. Indeed, I, Paul, say to you that if you become circumcised, Christ will profit you nothing. And I testify again to every man who becomes circumcised that he is a debtor to keep the whole law. You have become estranged from Christ, you who attempt to be justified by law. You have fallen from grace, for we, through the Spirit, eagerly await for the hope of righteousness by faith. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision avails anything, but faith working through love." So we can see here the false teaching that they were trying to require circumcision, you know, brought part of the old law and tried to bound it to other Christians in the new law. They were wanting to bind circumcision on it, and we know that would make null and void the new law. You're under bondage under the old law, and there's no way to be free from that. You know, it prevented those from obeying the truth. It was hindered through the false teaching. You know, and we can look at this. 2 Peter kind of voices the same thing. "You therefore, beloved, since you know this beforehand, beware lest you fall from your own steadfastness, being led away from the errors of the wicked." So we can't let other teachings and I know it says they're the wicked, and they're considered wicked by God. It may be somebody with a pure heart, pure mind, trying to do what's right, but err from the truth. And they're still called wicked here because they're not obeying God. And that can prevent or hinder any that is trying to follow God. That's what it says in verse 7, "Who hindered you from obeying the truth?" And false teaching was one of that. Second way is through sinful conduct in our lives. such as immorality, being a bad influence to others. You know, we looked at 1 Corinthians 15:33 and talked about the warnings about being influenced by others. Well, that can happen, and we can influence others in a bad way also. As it's says here, you know, and let's see if I got ahead of myself here again. I did. In Proverbs 18:9, it says, "He who is slothful in his work is a brother to him who is a great destroyer." So even how one works can show his influence and have an influence on those about you. So we have to work as a Christian would. Work, you know, as if God were our master there, serving him. We have to serve the one who is our boss and do right in all that we do there. We can't steal. We don't waste time of his when we're supposed to be working and getting paid there. It's an example that we can set that will have an effect on others, and this should be a warning to all Christians. It can be a good or a bad, and we've got to really appreciate how serious it is about how God feels about those who hinder those that are trying to do right. You know, from the words of Paul in Galatians, let's see if I got back too far here. Looks like mine had advanced a little bit. Let's see if I can get back to where I was. I apologize there. You know, we talked about from the words of Paul being leaven and leaven of the whole lump. In Galatians 5 and 9, a little leaven, leaven's whole lump. And also in 1 Corinthians 5, 6 and through 8, it says, "Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Therefore purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed to us. Therefore let us keep the feast, not with the old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth." Again, that's two other things we need to add, sincerity and truth, to these things to make us Christians in serving God that is right. And we don't need to be that bad influence. It says to get rid of that leaven out of our life, too. This is more spoken about the church. Sometimes we have to withdraw from some of those who are not in line with God, who are leavening the others, who may, you know, they're... sin may spread in the church, and we got to keep the church pure for God. So it could be withdrawing from someone is what it takes also. You know, negative influence, you know, will infect others. As James 3 and 5 says, just the tongue, a little spark can cause a great fire, can kindle a great fire. You know, we're going to bear judgment. We're going to be held accountable, as it says here in Galatians 5:10. "I have confidence in you and the Lord that you will have no other mind, but he who troubles you shall bear his judgment, whoever he is." So that's pretty strong words from the apostle who was inspired of God. We should, you know, there's a, you know, churches, I think, you know, it even talks about being cut off, as it has here in Galatians 5 and 12. "I could wish that those who are trouble you would even cut themselves off." You know, a lot of times there's some other so-called Church of Christ that have the name on there, but they have nothing. And when you go in and talk to the people, they don't worship anyway, according to the church that did in the first century there. And so, again, we wish, you know, a lot of times it'd be better if they would take that name off, because they don't resemble the church at all that God had set up and don't worship in the way that they should. But let's look from the words of Jesus, what woe would cause offenses or occasion to stumble and become a stumbling block, if you will. In Luke 17:1, says, "Then he said to his disciples, it is impossible that no offenses should come, but woe to him through whom they do come." And then the result of that will be in verse 2. It says, "It would be better for him if a millstone were hung to his neck and were thrown into the sea that he should offend one of these little ones." And again, these little ones are members of the kingdom at that time, so we've got to be sure and treat other brothers the same way. Jesus takes ministering or mistreating his disciples personally, as we see here in Matthew 25, verses 41 through 45. Then he will also say to those on the left hand, "Depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, you did not take me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick, and in prison, you did not visit me." Then they also will answer him, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry, or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, did not minister to you?" Then he will answer them, "Assuredly, I say to you, insomuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me." So again, our attitude towards our brothers and those outside are to be the caring, taking care of those and being a good example for those. And so we've got to be careful how we act. Jesus takes ministering, again, to his disciples personally, how we treat our other brothers in Christ. And Acts 9, 1 through 5 kind of reflects that same attitude that he's going to have. It says, "Then Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples, went to the high priest and asked letters from him to the synagogues of Damascus, so that if he found any who were of the way, whether men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. As he journeyed, he came near Damascus, and suddenly a light shone around him from heaven. Then he fell to the ground and heard a voice saying, 'Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?' And he said, 'Who are you, Lord?'" Can you imagine just walking down, thinking you're doing things right, thinking you're in the right, persecuting those of the Son of God, and then Christ coming and correcting him right there? We know, you know, Paul was going to be a strong disciple, a strong apostle for God there and for Christ, but he put a stop to his persecuting Christians there, and there are strong words that we don't hinder the brethren. You know, we can think about what happened in Jerusalem where they persecuted Christ and all that went on there where they were persecuting the church there. It was destroyed not long after that. So we need to make sure that we're not becoming a hindrance. How can we avoid becoming a hindrance? The first way is being a good example in our influence. You know, we've seen the Beatitudes, the fruits of the spirits, and look at some other things here, set examples as being salt and light. We're to be a good example. And, you know, for one another, as it talks about here in 1 Timothy 4:12, "Let no one despise your youth, but be an example to the believers in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity." And this is Paul's instructions to Timothy and then also to Titus about being an example for others there where they work. And in Titus 2, 7 and 8, "In all things showing yourself to be a pattern of good works, in doctrine showing integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that one who has an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say of you." And then we need to be an influence for those in the world too, as Matthew 5, 14 and 16 says, "You are the light of the world. The city is set on a hill, cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand and give it, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." And then Philippians 2, in verse 15 also says to shine as a light to the world, "that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God, without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation among whom you shine as lights in the world." And we can see that the best way we can be an example to one another, and it's brought up this morning, is faithful attendance. It's essential for good influence we have for one another. It's a good example for the babes in Christ, the spiritually weak, visitors, and it's a real good example for your own children. If you don't set that example for them, they're not going to follow it when they get older. You may think you can survive on maybe just coming once a week or whenever, you know, the thought may occur, you feel like getting out. But you've got to remember those other Christians, they need encouragement. They notice when you're gone. As Hebrews 10, 25 says, "Do not forsake the assembling of the saints." And to to avoid that, we have to have faithful attendance. It influences those from the outside, too. You know, a lot of people will see you. Our neighbors all know we go to church every Sunday and Wednesday, and they mention it every once in a while, too. You can have an influence on a lot of people. One guy I work with on the phone all the time, he asks what I'm doing that night, and then he'll go, oh, wait, it's Wednesday. Never mind. I know what you're doing. So, you know, you can have an influence on others, and friends, relatives, neighbors. That's what 1 Peter 2 and 12 says, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, when they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. You know, I think people would admire conviction and devotion to the Lord. They may begin to wonder, what makes you devoted to the church? Why are you devoted to the church? Why do you have such a desire? And then they ask about it, and you can explain it to them. It provides great support to the men here at the church. If we had elders, it was great support to them, those and other Christians. Your presence alone is a source of great encouragement, and your absence creates concern for anyone that's concerned about your spiritual welfare. You know, we can't escape being an influence to others, so we've got to ask ourselves, are we going to be influenced for good or for bad? Yet, here's another reason that to attend services every time that's possible, because we want to influence those of our brothers. We've got to give careful attention to our example. Again, Paul encouraged Timothy, as we saw in 1 Timothy 4:12, let no one despise your youth, but be an example to the believers in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, and in purity. Give attention to our attitude. You know, we can inspire others by our love, spirit, speech, and faith, as he talked about here. You know, we need to be a source of encouragement to those around us, and an example to our kids and other fellow Christians. You know, give attention to proclaiming the word, too. If you have an opportunity to teach others about what you say every day in life, you know, our words matter, what we say, too, whether in private or public. Are they building up? Are they encouraging? Or do they tear down and take away from God? This is how we tell others if we're, you know, we can tell others if we're drawing closer to God. And when we can teach others when they ask about the opportunities, about our stance on things, and when we speak to them about things, they'll see we have a different speech than others do. You know, so we're either going to help or hinder our brethren in Christ. Christians should be a great source of encouragement to one another. And how great it's going to be, you know, if we encourage one another and we get to spend that eternity together in heaven. This time, this hasn't been a lesson for those of the first principles, but if anyone owes a duty to God to come forward and be baptized, if you haven't taken that first step, or if you owe any other duty, to come forward as we stand and sing.